You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Back with us this week is Arthur Jamfa to talk about Tyrion again. Who doesn't love to talk about Tyrion? Steve and I cover The Watchers on the Wall. This is a action-packed episode, and Steve and I both absolutely loved it. And for my bird's eye view section, I include an excerpt of my conversation with Jan Doolittle Wilson. We talk a lot about Penny. If you're not familiar with Penny, then you should reread the latest novel, because Penny is Tyrion's traveling companion. They're both in a traveling show together. They're both little people, and she happens to be one of Jan's favorite characters. Again, my apologies about the audio in my conversation with Steve. It is shoddy. It's not great. You deserve better. I'm bad. You're good. I'm ugly. You're handsome. Without further ado, here is Arthur Jamfa. All right. Hey, Arthur. So when I was in England, my name got changed from Anthony to Antony.
Oh, of course it did, yeah.
So do you have the same problem?
So actually, that's quite funny, because I arrived in London and was six, right?
Okay.
And I went to like a bilingual school, so half of it was in French and half of it was in English.
Uh-huh.
And some people, and I specifically remember my fencing coaches, insisted on calling me Arthur, my English fencing coaches, which would annoy me so much.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to become British, because you put me in the country when I was six, so that's inevitably what happened. And then people were calling me by a French name, and it made me very, very unhappy, because it's an English name. And, you know, you could analyze
it. It's just an English name. It's the English name.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It is. Can you get more British than Arthur? Like, come on. You can't be kidding me, calling me Arthur.
All right, so that's interesting. So most people don't call you Arthur, they call you Arthur.
Yeah, I mean, I insist on never being called Arthur. I correct people immediately. Right.
Okay. All right, so you make sure people do that. All right, so, I mean, certainly the Brits can say TH. They can do it.
Yeah.
Well, then why was I Antony the whole time? I guess I just didn't care too much to correct anyone.
I also think Antony is a bit posher. So maybe you have posh friends. I mean, I don't want to make accusations about perhaps you surround yourself with posh people in academic circles that are more comfortable with Antony than with Antony.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't people who were fancy people, they were trying to act like fancy people. Jeez. All right. Hey, Arthur, I love this. I was reading this chapter and I was
thinking, oh, tell me about it.
This is just a brilliant chapter. I was thinking, and I do this every now and again. I'll be like, oh, this is my favorite chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I like it so much is that you get to see Tyrion's mind at its sharpest. He's in this dire situation. Like, he's desperate. And he knows that the only way to get out is to outthink everyone else in this castle. And he absolutely does it.
Tyrion fans, this is just, what a chapter. And it's also the first few Tyrion chapters are so frustrating, and the first like introduction to Tyrion, because when you've read the rest of it and then you come back to this, you're like, but wait, this isn't the Tyrion that I know. This is some kind of, what's he doing rolling around on the floor? Who is this?
Mm.
And then slowly he changes, and this is where I'm like, okay, this is Tyrion admitting to a room full of people that he's slept with hundreds of prostitutes while completely outsmarting them. This is it. Like, we've arrived. this is a Tyrion that I love, and so that's why for me I'm like, I love this chapter.
Yeah, let me do a synopsis of the chapter, and then we can talk about it. Tyrion has spent several nights in the Eyrie's dungeon, which is a stone room with only three walls and a floor that slopes toward nothing but sky. He is cold, hungry, and angry at his mistreatment. The Goler is a simpleton named Mord who taunts him, throws his food into the wind, and kicks Tyrion with steel-pointed boots. Tyrion reflects on his first interrogation by Lady Lysa and her six-year-old son. Lysa has accused him of killing her husband. Tyrion mocked the accusations with sarcasm and ended up in a sky cell for it. Driven by desperation, Tyrion hatches a plan to get himself free. He bribes Mord to send a message to Lysa. When brought to court, he demands a trial. When granted, he demands a trial by combat. After Ser Vardis Egan is selected to be Lysa's champion, Tyrion waits to see if Bronn will rise to the challenge. His gamble pays off as Bronn agrees to be Tyrion's champion. So, Arthur Jumpa, you want to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I wonder if you can predict what I'm going to choose.
I think that you are going to... I think that you're going to choose a character.
Oof.
And I think it's Tyrion.
I actually think I really hesitated between that and I want to try Ladder of Chaos because I didn't last time. And I feel like I'm missing out. So I'm going to take the Ladder of Chaos. But the first one...
You were so... Sir, you poo-pooed the Ladder of Chaos last time.
I did. But, you know, I clearly I'm just a trend follower. I'm just a hype man. And the trend is now back to Ladder of Chaos. So I just follow the trend here.
Okay. All right. You go first.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was going to say that the first rung of my Ladder of Chaos is absolutely going to be Tyrion, because I want to break down how he does this, because I think there's a tendency of being just like, oh, Tyrion's just a genius. He's just capable of managing the situations and completely sneaks them out. But you can see at certain points, like the moment where he convinces Mord, who is the man who's keeping him prisoner, he convinces
the turnkey,
yeah, that's his name. He convinces him to listen to him, to deliver a message to Lysa, and then he starts thinking like, oh, what should I say? And for me, that's a really revealing moment about Tyrion, that he isn't a man that really plans things out and thinks things through and creates these amazing plans, but he's just so incredibly quick-witted that he outsmarts everyone by just making on-the-spot decisions.
Yeah, sometimes he does that. Sometimes he'll have sort of a general idea in mind. Like, for instance, I think he's thinking, I need to befriend Bronn early on. Mm-hmm. I think he's been trying to make friends with Bronn, like, for weeks.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, a week or what, however long it takes to get to the Eyrie.
Yeah.
I need to get into a situation where I can demand trial by combat, and I think I'm going to gamble that Bronn steps forward. So I think he's been planning that for a while, but he doesn't know exactly how he's going to get there. And so you're absolutely right that there are moments where he's thinking, okay, I need to try something else. Like right now, I need to try it right now and see what happens.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, in that way, he's impulsive.
And even the time where he, just before the end, when the plan is about to go well, like Bronn fire saying, you know, I'll take it on, he suddenly thinks, oh, is this a colossal mistake? So even after everything he's done, he's still second guessing himself and not certain. Yeah. And also, what's also so incredible about this chapter is the fact that, unlike the show, and we can talk about show differences later, but unlike the show, we're not seeing this. Most of this chapter is his recollections.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I feel like it's also, we're very much in his mind during this chapter. So what we're doing is very much a psychoanalysis of how his mind works, how he does these things. And we're introduced... Yeah. And we're introduced to him regretting almost all of his decisions, to him not really knowing what he's doing, but somehow finding his way through, because on the moment he says these things are just the right thing to say most of the time.
Well, one thing that you said that I absolutely want to follow here is you said you want to talk about how he sort of makes all this happen, mm-hmm. right? So here's what I wrote down. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Tyrion uses Mord's greed to get to court, right? So he he uses sort of that. That's sort of the low cunning that he accuses Cersei of earlier in the chapter.
Yeah, exactly.
But then when he's at court, he has to use a different tact. He has to use the pride of the Vale to his benefit.
Yeah.
And he has to make these Knights of the Vale and the, you know, Lady Lysa feel a sense of shame that the Vale is a place where there's no justice.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I'm going to read this one little part here. Okay, so basically, he's done his little thing where he's made everyone laugh, but then he's refused to confess to the murder. And he says, "Is this how justice is done in the Vale?" Tyrion roared so loudly that Ser Vardis froze for an instant. "Does honor stop at the bloody gate? You accuse me of crimes. I deny them. So you throw me into an open cell to freeze and starve." He lifted his head to give them all a good look at the bruises Mord had left on his face. "Where is the king's justice? Is the Eyrie not part of the Seven Kingdoms? I stand accused, you say. Very well. I demand a trial. Let me speak. Let me speak my truth or falsehood. Be judged openly in the sight of gods and men." So Tyrion uses their sense of shame against them, right? Because they value their honor. They want to be known as a place of justice.
Yeah.
So then he uses greed to get out, he uses shame to get a trial, and then he uses religion to get a trial by combat. Because he's basically saying, let the gods judge me. I want a trial by combat.
I see.
And they have to go along. So he uses low cunning, and then he uses these social norms that he knows will, in the end, he has to gamble, right?
Yeah, but you know what it reminds me of that passage later when Varys talks about power. And so he says a man walks up and we have one priest and we have a king and we have a very rich mm-hmm. man mm-hmm. and all three of them ask this man to kill the two others, and the mm-hmm. priest says, "In the name of the seven gods, you have to kill them, right. And you will not go to the seven hells." And the king says, "I will make you a lord, I will make you a knight." And the very rich man says, "I will give you all of the gold that you want to eat." And then Varys' conclusion is, "Power is wherever men believe it relies." And Tyrion makes great use of that, right? He uses those three weapons of different mm-hmm. types of power, even though he's in a powerless situation. He uses outside power that he can leverage because of his position as a lord and an important person in the realm.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I hadn't thought of it, but now that you recall that, I think I remember Martin saying that quote from Varys is probably sort of the heart of his story. Like, it's like sort of the key theme.
Yeah.
And clearly we see in this chapter that it's true. They're all living by these mythologies, and Tyrion knows it and manipulates them.
But can we talk about the audience for a second? Because there's no group of people in this whole book I hate as much as the court of the Eyrie, because they are the reason for this, and they are so incredibly annoying. And they are so easily manipulated in this way. They laugh at every joke for no reason and have absolutely no loyalty in their reactions. They're so over the top. Like, at one point, Tyrion is like, "Oh, I want to try, but I come back." And they all just start dying laughing. Like, that passage is absolutely ridiculous, the way that he just describes them just over the top laughing. They just seem... a whole court of just idiotic people who have no sense of politics and what's going on around them except some kind of...
I'll tell you how I read that. Maybe you read it differently. I read that as they've never seen a man eschew his own sense of honor before by demanding a champion. They've seen women, they might have seen women do that, but I think that it would be generally thought that if you're a man and you demand trial by combat, you're probably going to do it yourself, or otherwise people are going to think you're a coward. And I think that when Tyrion, who's a man, demands a champion, it may be the first time that they've ever seen a man do that before, and that's why they laugh.
But what I don't understand is, like, Tyrion will say something funny, making fun of their lords and of Lysa, and then they all like laugh and like stifle the laughter really badly. And then Robin makes a really bad joke because he's six, and then they all start laughing. And then Lysa, with a terrible wit, makes a joke and they start laughing. And Tyrion says something mildly shocking, and they all like gasp. It's just so annoying. What is wrong with them?
Yeah, it really does give you the sense that they, at court, everyone's got their courtly face on.
Mm-hmm.
And so nothing is authentic. And so one of Tyrion's superpower is that he can walk into a room where everyone's pretending to be something that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And just by pointing the finger at something that's authentic and naming it, sometimes in a crude way or whatever, but naming it, is so incongruous with the social setting that you can't help but laugh because there's an incongruity there.
Mm.
The other thing I was going to say is that to be a rich man without shame in this world is like a superpower. If you're rich, the money matters a little bit less to you, but your real currency in the realm is how highly people think of you. But if you're someone like... if you're like someone like Walder Frey, you're a rich man, so you've got the money, but then you don't have a sense of shame about it, you can get away with a lot of stuff. You know, it's like everyone else is fighting with one hand tied behind their back. But if you have no shame, you can kind of do a lot of things that other people wouldn't even try to do.
Yeah, and I think, you need money, you also need status, obviously, I think. But I absolutely agree with you, and it's almost represented by later the next Catelyn chapter, when we see Bronn fighting the knight that fights for that from knight fights for the Vale, and he basically can't fight because he's in his knight gear and he has to fight in this honorable way, and
he's Bronn fighting with one hand tied behind his back. He's quite
literally a representation of how Tyrion beat them.
Yeah, because Bronn has no sense of shame, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's gonna fight dirty, he's gonna fight however he wants. So Tyrion has lived this life whereby he's sort of the source of ridicule, and he's sort of learned the lesson that you can survive ridicule. And so he doesn't mind ridiculing other people. He doesn't mind ridiculing himself. He's sort of desensitized to the ridicule part of it. Whereas someone like Lady Lysa, how many people would actually dare to insult Lady Lysa?
That's true.
So for her, Tyrion's sarcasm is going to hurt really badly because she just never has had to deal with that kind of thing before.
I also think... and maybe this is a bit meta, but I also think George Martin gives quite an advantage to Tyrion in this, but with this setting, because he is intentionally creating quite a creepy atmosphere with the veil, and he does this thing where he kind of exaggerates everyone's personality.
Right. I got that sense too.
Yeah, so like he's creating these big walls that are completely white, and it's not usually what would be creepy, right? But by just exaggerating everything, the little 6-year-old kid is extra 6-year-old, Lysa is extra Lysa, the knights are extra knights, etc., etc. It's a bit like Get Out, right? He's trying to creep us out by creating this kind of like whole performance, and that makes it super easy for Tyrion the character to walk along because they're predictable. And if people are predictable, Tyrion can outsmart them. Like the first thing he says about Mords at the start of the chapter is that he is as dumb as he is predictable, and that's the thing about the whole Vale. They are creepy because they're predictably exaggerated. So Tyrion can play them like a fiddle.
And knowing their predictability, he knows how to manipulate that situation if he acts unpredictably.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, he's also willing to gamble. And I don't know if this bespeaks his intelligence or if he's just getting lucky.
Okay, just before we get off Tyrion and we start talking about other things. I want to talk about, because we talked about it quickly, but I want to talk about Tyrion, his relationship with death. Because I'm can't figure out if he cheats death because he's really intelligent or if he cheats death because he's got amazing plot armor. And that, I mean, that's really down to how realistic Martin is, is making his cheating death moment, right?
Just so we get everyone on the same page, can you describe what plot armor is?
Yeah, it's a bit of a nerdy term that means when a character is too important to the storyline to be killed at that moment in time. Therefore, in a moment where really they should die, somehow they don't die. I mean, you see this happening all the time, like an arrow is about to kill someone and hits the wall just next to them. And that's a, you know, tip, or, you know, someone shoots them and then they have a coin in their, in their pocket.
Yeah, doesn't kill them. Doesn't serve the plot
exactly
for this character to die at the moment. And of course, you know, we've got this. Tyrion is one of the most important characters in the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly he's not going to die, die right here. Right. So now plot armor is fun to point out in retrospect, right?
Yes.
Anyway, all right. So now that we have our terms defined, continue.
And so whether it's plot armor, whether it is Tyrion's wit, comes down to how convincing Martin is, right? I'm not convinced that I am convinced that Tyrion can escape death this many times. And just to stay on this chapter, is this convincing? Is this possible? That he gets out of this situation? What do you think?
I think I love the chapter so much that I think that the answer has to be that it's convincing.
Yeah.
Because if I was thinking, oh, bullshit. <That's> if it ever occurred to me, like, I only thought bullshit once at one point during the chapter, but I'll bring that up later.
Okay.
But if that was on the front of my mind, I would not have enjoyed the chapter.
Mm.
And it could just be that I'm enjoying it so much that I'm willing to overlook some of these little chinks in Martin's armor, right?
Yeah.
But I think that part of what makes it convincing is that you see that it's a calculated gamble. And what he's gambling on is all of these social norms, because if the norms fall apart, the society collapses. I mean, that's how they view these things, right?
Of course.
You know, no one's going to sort of dishonor the gods. No one's going to cop to the fact that the veil is a place of injustice, because doing so makes the entire mythology fall apart, and all the people with power who rely on the mythology, their power is sort of undermined. So Tyrion is absolutely gambling, but the gamble pays off because he believes that the mythology is important to these people. And he's absolutely right that it is. Now, there's a couple times where he's, you know, it's kind of, the gamble is like, you're gambling quite a bit on Mord here. you got your life in Mord's hands, and Mord is a wild card, you know? So, I mean, there's situations like that, or that Bronn will step forward in the end. That's the biggest gamble of all, right?
Yes. He could not have known that.
He's been laying the foundation for that, and he's hoping that it'll pay off. Like, but to see it come to fruition is gratifying enough that I wasn't thinking, yeah, would a free rider like Bronn really risk his life? I don't know. I wasn't thinking that at all. So what about you? What were you thinking?
Right, so I also think it is convincing, but I think it's convincing because Tyrion's mouth almost kills him as many times as it saves him. And that's why I'm absolutely convinced is that it gets him into the situation. It also gets him out and he gets a setback and then he comes back and he gets a setback. And that for to me is realistic, right? If his mouth is capable of doing that much, it is also capable of causing a lot of bad things for him. But he doesn't have complete control over it. No one could possibly ever. And so I am convinced because I think, yeah, it is this kind of roller coaster of emotions that he's going through. Because like somehow his wit is just carrying him towards directions that he doesn't control. Mm-hmm. And it's that's why I think Martin's making a convincing case as to why this is believable.
That's interesting. Now, when you first said Tyrion's relationship to death, I thought you were going to go a different direction.
Oh, okay. Tell me.
I think that Tyrion is... there are a couple hints here that Tyrion struggles at times with suicidal ideation.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, that the Sky Cells are totally designed to make someone suffer long enough to, you know, just be cold long enough, to be hungry long enough, to become desperate enough to take their own life. And here we have Tyrion, who just a few chapters previous, you know, he saw his horse getting butchered and he thought, well, maybe the horse has the better outcome.
Yes,
because I'm miserable. And then, of course, we know much later in Dance that, that he actually is actively thinking about taking his own life.
Yes. Yeah. And I think perhaps that is a major factor that probably causes a lot of things here, because like the way he says, he's just there to rot. But he says, I don't think I can rot for much longer. And there's two ways of interpreting that, right? Yeah. But perhaps it's because of his physical disabilities, and that he doesn't think he can hold because he's getting weak. But perhaps it's because mentally he just cannot hold as long as other people would. And so they assume, okay, you know, we know people can last 2-3 weeks into the Sky Cell. Well, he knows, oh, I can't, you know, in a few days I'm going to jump off. So perhaps this is all caused by his mental inability to kind of push off those suicidal thoughts.
And maybe it's suggestive of, this is the kind of guy who would gamble his life by demanding a trial by combat.
Also true.
I don't think he ideates very often at this point. I mean, eventually he will. Eventually he'll actually put poisonous mushrooms in his pocket and think about eating them and thinking that this is actually a good thing if he does. But he has to be brought really low for that to happen. Mm-hmm. Right? He has to kill his own father to make that happen.
Yeah.
But at this point, I think we just see little seeds that it's in the back of his mind. He wants to live, but there's this little voice back there that he, you know, he can usually keep silent. And I think we've seen a couple hints of that so far.
And I think also the last Tyrion chapter, you talked about to what extent we need to talk about the author's intent. And when we're talking about Tyrion, kind of like suicidal thoughts creeping in a way that is so seamless. What does that tell us about Martin? Is he just so incredibly good at simulating that he's capable of doing that seamlessly, or is it some reflection of something he'd gone through in his past? I guess we don't know, but it is.
Are you suggesting that we should remove all of the knives from Martin's kitchen?
No. That's not what I'm suggesting.
I think we should.
You think you should?
All of the knives. We're getting rid of all the knives out of Martin's, four different houses that he owns.
I think we should talk to Martin. We should check. I think someone check. My message to the world is someone check on Total Martin, if no one has.
Oh, goodness. Well, I think that he gets a lot of credit for these plot twists, and people view these books as brilliantly plot-driven books, but I don't think he gets enough credit for the fact that these books are very, very character-driven. and that there are hundreds of characters in these books, and we're seeing, you know, POVs from, I don't know, 20 different characters throughout the series. That's, if anyone that's tried their hand at fiction, that is not easy to do.
Can we talk about, you know, last time we talked about Tyrion, you talked about him becoming a dragon, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Twice in this chapter, they mention him having wings. The first time,
I love it.
The first time he is like looking over the edge and he says, I'm like a bee in a stone honeycomb and someone clipped off his wings. And the second time is Elias that mocks him and asks him, do dwarf have wings? And if not, shut up because I'm going to throw you off. And I think that we're getting more hints. And I think every single person that comes to the podcast and Tyrion is mentioned should look out for Tyrion is going to become a dragon theory.
This is why I love doing this podcast. I'm clearly convinced by my own theory, right? That metaphorically or in some other way, he's going to become a dragon, or maybe he's just a Targaryen or something like that, which means that he's a dragon. And so I'm actively looking for things like that, but I absolutely miss those, and I wouldn't have heard them unless you pointed them out. So thank you for doing that.
I'm happy to help. You can add it to your blog post.
Oh my goodness. I'm so happy about this. I wanted to point out something about this chapter that I really enjoyed. I think there's a great showcase of the way that ancient literacy and ancient orality functioned in this chapter.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So there's at least three different ways in which Martin uses the concept of literacy to help him world build in this chapter. And the first way is that he sees that there's written on the wall these two lines that said, you know, the gods save me, the blue is calling, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something that looks suspiciously like blood.
Yeah, like someone's maybe written this in blood. And so my immediate thought was that, oh, Martin doesn't know how ancient cultures work because, you know, 99% of this culture is going to be illiterate. You know, the person in this sky cell would have to be like a person of noble birth to be able to write at all and to write so poetically.
That's true.
And then I thought, so Martin doesn't know what he's doing. Of course, I'm foolish. I'm totally foolish. And the reason why I thought that was that because Tyrion was reading silently to himself on his way up to the wall. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely not how people read in the ancient world. To read silently to oneself is a very modern thing. I was sort of like looking down my nose at Martin. And then just a few paragraphs later, Martin pays it off. He says, look, Mord views the written word either is going to view it either as something to be suspicious of or something that holds so much authority, it's almost like magic. Mm. And then I was like eating humble pie because I was thinking, oh, that's absolutely, he's got his thumb on the pulse of ancient orality. Martin is a genius. And so that's exactly how you'd view writing in the ancient world. And in fact, not only did it almost have like magical authority, sometimes it was magical. Sometimes it was written to be a magical incantation. So if you were illiterate, like Mord is, and someone is willing to write it out, like I promise to pay you this amount of money, it's like someone just like wrote the Bible in front of you. So you're going to totally respect that. So then I thought, oh, good God, Martin's a genius and I'm a dummy, right? And then ultimately, he pays it off a third time in the chapter when he writes that Meriliane is going to sing this story around the kingdom. Mm-hmm. Meriliane actually has a lot of power, and Tyrion's able to sort of manipulate that power because in an oral culture, the ability to memorize a story via song is absolutely a propaganda tool.
Yeah,
how stories are disseminated. They're disseminated by singers who are traveling from town to town. And so Tyrion knows that because Marillion's in the room, he can look at Marillion and say, hey, when this song is sung, make sure you tell them that Lady Lysa did not allow me a champion. And of course, Lysa is totally manipulated by this. She doesn't want to be known as someone who denied him justice. So Tyrion is manipulating what he knows is going to be the oral telling of this. In other words, Marillion's functioning in many ways like the free press. And so Tyrion knows to use that for his political gain. So in those three ways, you really see this intersection between literacy and in an oral culture play out in this chapter. And that, Arthur, made me very happy.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And to the point of whoever wrote that in the Sky Cells, Tyrion wonders at first who it is and then decides that he doesn't
know. It had
to
be someone. It had to be a wealthy person, someone with a good education. And that makes Tyrion think even more like, my status in the kingdom is not going to save me necessarily. I've got to do something out of my desperation here.
Yeah, it adds a lot of context to the chapter, actually. Yeah, that makes sense.
All right, your turn. What else you got?
I want to talk about impregnable fortresses because I think they're very, very cool. And before we talk about impregnable fortresses, I wanted to hijack your podcast again and ask you questions.
Okay, let's do it.
I've got the top three most impregnable fortresses in the world, and I want to know if you could guess. I'll give you three guesses. If you guess one of them, you win.
Okay. Oh, goodness.
I don't know the odds are.
I don't know fortresses very well, but yeah, try me.
No, go on. You just have to say a country where fortress.
Okay.
So, okay, I'll give you hints. It has to be a country where there's been a lot of like fortress warfare.
They need to have
held off someone that keeps attacking. Uh-huh. Hint, it's always the British. Again. And no, I think that's and by the British I mean the English, actually. Sorry. And then that's all. So I don't know.
Okay, so I will get this right if I can name one of three.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say Wales.
Oh, that's close, but not one.
All right, Scotland.
Yes, that is one. Ding ding ding! Come on, you can get a second one.
Second, France.
Yes, and you've done two out of three. And the third one is India. So really everyone that the English attacked a lot.
And so tell me about these fortresses.
So the first one is, I think, Muru Janjira. I think, okay, someone who's from India is going to send you an email and apologize for me, for my pronunciation. But it's like a massive island fortress. It's off the coast of India, and it's absolutely amazing. It's the island is just a fortress. There are these massively high walls that I think are 40 feet high. There's 19 rounded bastions, and it's just like has one massive entrance so you can get through. And throughout the whole time of the British Raj, the British could not colonize it. So they colonized the whole of India, but this one impregnable fortress, they just let the people inside have their own independent state and like govern themselves.
And what's it called again?
Muru Janjira.
All right. What about Scotland?
Scotland is number three. And this is the Edinburgh Castle. So really famous. Anyone from Scotland will know it. It's been besieged more than 25 times in this history. And it was never taken by force. So they need to find another way to bribe them out, but they never took them by just barging themselves in. And then, you know, technology happened. They just bombarded the castle during the Second World War. But before then, it was untouchable. So again, once you have the English next to you, or knocking at your door, you find good ways of defending yourself, which brings me to the last one, which is the Mont Saint-Michel in France. It's got a high tide and a low tide. So it's really difficult to get to. And in the whole Hundred Years' War, which basically every part of France was conquered and unconquered, they were like so close to the British and never got impregnated, whatever it's called.
You mean the English, right?
Yeah, the English never got into Mont Saint-Michel.
The English, they really needed dragons.
Although I'm
this scared. Could have all been solved if they just had dragons.
Although, considering people had to build to ward off the English, I'm scared what would happen if they had dragons.
I want to point out one way. At one point, I called bullshit.
Yeah, you mentioned that before.
I'm not an astronomy buff, all right? Like I study languages, I study history, whatever. I don't know a lot about the stars. But I do know that I've been on the top of mountains before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never looked down and seen stars. Tyrion is able to look through the moon door, which is, I guess, supposed to be on the floor, right?
I guess.
It's not on the side of the... It's not on the wall or anything. It's on the floor.
Are you getting confused by the show here?
I don't think so. I think that there's a description of the moon door that's it says it's in the floor. But anyway, Tyrion looks through the moon door and it's speckled with stars. He sees the sky below. Yeah, I can buy that. The sky is below. Fine. You cannot see stars out the moon door. That... unless this world is so foreign that this is such a fantasy narrative that stars are actually the souls of fairies or something, there's no way you're going to see stars through the floor.
No, I think you've been influenced by the show here, because it says a narrow wayward door stood between two slender marble pillars. Now, I don't know where you see pillars along the floor. But
oh, good night.
I think you did it again. We'll assume that the moon door is on the floor, being that no one's paid attention to the book. But actually, it seems it's just a normal door.
Oh, good God! I did it again.
Yeah, you've doubted.
I was trying to call Martin out as a fool. Clearly, mm-hmm. I was the fool. I missed the moon door. It's clearly on the wall.
It's crazy, because I read this and I did not even, like, it says between two marble pillars. I remember reading this and be like, marble pillars? That's weird. And then it says, one man removed the heavy bronze bars, the second pulled the door inwards. I mean, it's quite clearly a door. And
inwards is clearly, you would pull the door upwards if it was on the floor.
Absolutely. And there's no bronze bar. Would it be a bronze bar if it was I mean, that makes no sense.
Clearly, this is on the wall, and of course you're going to see stars through the wall.
Of course, you're going to see stars through the wall. So you've identified a show difference. Mm-hmm. I think it's much more dramatic.
Well, I didn't just do that. I identified how my perception of the book is so colored by the show that I've been hoisted by my own petard, Arthur. I was trying to get Martin.
Oh, I see.
And I got myself.
Yeah. I mean, for the third time this podcast?
This is the last time you're coming on. I am not at my best when you're on.
But I think
you too often you reveal me to be incorrect.
I think we've come to a conclusion that Martin is as good a writer as he can be within the 90s. I think that is the conclusion we have to come to.
All right. So notable introductions in this chapter. Mord, we meet Mord and his chunky fingers and rotten teeth. We learn about the sky cells and high hall of the Eyrie. Alba Royce, Sir Lynn Corbray, Lord Hunter, Lady Wainwood.
I hate them all.
These are horrible people. Mm. But for me, the most interesting introduction is Trial by Combat. Because... usually what Martin will do is he will hint at a custom or a bit of world building much earlier in the story. That's so true. When it becomes a plot point, you've heard of it before. Even if you didn't sort of understand what it meant, you've seen the seed planted earlier. But when Tyrion demands trial by combat, it's the first time you hear that phrase in the entire book. And I thought it was interesting because it has not been foreshadowed at all. It's clearly key to Tyrion's plan, but Tyrion hasn't let you in on his plan. And when he calls it out, the reaction in the room is sort of like, oh, well, Even though he's our prisoner, he's absolutely within his rights to demand trial by combat. And I think it's because the phrase is so self-explanatory that Martin really doesn't have to explain what it is.
Sure.
And so I thought it was interesting that the trial by combat is introduced here, but not foreshadowed previously in the book.
That is huge, especially since it becomes massive later, right? Everyone always considers...
Everyone always considers,
wait, if we do trial, will he do trial by combat? What does that mean? Blah, 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 blah.
Well, on top of that, it's it's a big deal for Tyrion twice, right?
Yes.
And we think, we don't know this for sure, but we think it will be an issue for Cersei's situation. You know, there's speculation that the Hound will sort of come to the Faith of the Seven.
Mm.
And that Cersei will demand a champion and choose, Ser Strong. Mm. Who is the mountain, right?
Yeah.
Frankenstein's mountain or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that you'll see that these two brothers fight it out because Cersei demands trial by combat. Now, in the show, the political intrigue is that the High Sparrow gets Tommen to outlaw trial by combat. But anyway, it's an important part of the plot that gets introduced here.
Yeah. No. Huge.
Book differences here. Clearly, we've noted that the Moon Door is different, right?
Yes.
Does the show do the thing where he starts his joke about he once brought a jackass and a honeycomb into a brothel and then he can't finish the joke?
Is that scene? I think it might be right,
my uncle's boots with goat shit. When confronted with my crime, I blamed a squire. Poor boy was flogged and I escaped justice when I was 12. I milked my eel into a pot of turtle stew. I flogged the one-eyed snake. I skinned my sausage. I made the bald man cry into the turtle stew, which I do believe my sister ate. At least I hope she did. I once brought a jackass and a honeycomb into a brothel.
Silence! What happened next?
Arthur, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you. In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers. If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I talk about Watchers on the Wall. This is that episode where the wall gets attacked from both sides by the free folk. And Steve and I talk a lot about Sam's libido. Here is comic Steve Osborne.
Steve, did you ever read Playboy for the articles?
That was such a classic, comment, right?
It's a little slice of life from a different era.
Right. And what I appreciate is that, I mean, you know, there were like, I know as a kid, like you'd see something like, I don't know, I'd like an interview or they'd mention like, you know, they interviewed in Playboy and I'd like, what, really? And so, I mean, they had, you know, there were, I think, legit journalists.
Yeah. Getting interviewed for Playboy, it was like a little notch in your cap because it was sort of like, I'm part of the counterculture and I'm interesting enough to be subversive.
Sure. That's where, you know, looking back, it's like, well, then now that kind of Playboy for the articles thing is, it's humorous, but it would be way more powerful if it was like Hustler.
Well, I was just going to say that. I was just going to think like Sam is in desperate need of like a penthouse testimonial. He just needs someone to explain to him how it all works.
Right.
And if it's in poetic form, so be it. He needs like a too short. He needs like a too short album.
Right, exactly. Freaky Tales would have gone a long way with.
That's what Sam's missing. And John is not helping him out.
No.
John is like, I don't kiss and tell. I don't care if this is your last night on Earth.
No doubt.
Like, Sam does not have a high aspirations for his last night on Earth. All he wants is for one guy to say, yeah, this is what it was like.
Just give me a body story, man.
Sam does seem like the kind of guy who would read Playboy cover to cover.
Right.
I mean, not to say he would not also, you know, look at the photographs, but he would read it from cover to cover.
Yeah, he'd know their bios.
Sure. Yeah, he's that kind of guy. Tormund is into bears.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about a penthouse testimonial.
Yeah, that's a thing.
So, do you think this is a story he just tells to get a laugh, or do you think he's got, there's something here? Because it is Game of Thrones.
Right, and I do like the ideas like this one again.
Yeah. Ygritte's heard this story a dozen times.
It's like, oh boy. It's not enough that it's like, oh, look at me, I'm interesting, or it's supposed to be a flex, but it's like, dude, give me like three or four bear stories and I'm in.
Okay. So there's the Bear and the Maiden Fair, right? Which is a song really about a bear and a girl. And now we have Tormund boasting that he's once made love to a she bear.
Yeah.
And so either there's sort of like a meme going around, or this is a thing. And it becomes mythology. You have to kind of package it as a song or a body tale around the campfire. But this is kind of a thing.
Yeah. I mean,
you got dead men coming back to life. You got dragons. I find it somewhat like I'm willing to believe it. I'm willing to believe Tormund on this.
Yeah. It's like, you know, we all have those friends who are like, you know, it'll be a perfectly good discussion going on, and then someone will just come out of left field with this, like, apropos of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize, like, it's just one of those, or you'll all be having a good conversation. Someone's clearly left out, and then that person decides, oh, look, there's a piano, I'll play it. And you're like, all right, I guess we're doing this now.
Speaking of sweet vermouth, have I ever told you about the time I made love to a bear?
Exactly, right. And you're like, hey, this is a great story, and I do want to have this conversation, but can you put this in the parking lot while we...
All right, this scene, or this episode was unlike anything I've seen. And I think it's hard to make these medieval set pieces work.
We've talked about how, you know, like, kind of battle fatigue, potentially. Yeah.
How did you... I was really impressed by this.
I was riveted.
The whole thing about the wall being so high that the arrows aren't going to go up there, and then the giant with the giant arrow.
Wow, that was good.
I have not seen that on the screen before, so that was really great.
Yeah, that one really. That I was fully prepared to have this be like, all right, no, I'll watch it, but I won't. You know, yeah, but I was. Start to finish, I was super locked in. Everything seemed to work. All the Sam moments worked. The John and Ygritte moment worked, and I honestly didn't think I was gonna. But that was a good one because that was one of those Game of Thrones. I don't know where this is gonna go.
Yeah.
I had thought Sam was gonna kill her, if you know. But I thought she was gonna kill John.
Right. Man. Well, And I think it was interesting how they played that. Like, she's hell-bent on killing him. And right. then she finally gets close enough to do it, and he smiles at her. And all of a sudden, she doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And it was almost like he smiled despite of himself. He's like, I know you're probably going to kill me, but it's just really good to see you again.
Yeah, no, that's how I got it, right? And I think that's what was the disarming, because it was so... I think we all had the same reaction as Ygritte. Like, well, really?
Yeah, wow. right.
And then you're also like, yeah, but no, I guess. And so then that moment where she pauses, I think we all pause. And I think that was a super effective scene with that. And that's when I'm like, oh no, maybe she's going to die. And then I was like, oh, Sam could kill her. Sam kills her. Like, what does that do to their relationship, right?
So we see the death of Ygritte, the death of Gren.
Yeah.
So he died under the wall, and the giant was named Mag the Mighty. Not that you'd know that, because I don't think they ever mentioned it in the show. But the giant's dead, and Pip is also dead.
Yeah, yeah.
So he got an arrow right through his throat.
Yeah, that was not pleasant.
So all of these people super close to Jon died, and that's quite a death count. I mean, and that's, yeah. And this season, I mean, just the death count on this season alone is Joffrey, Oberyn, and then the three we just mentioned.
Right.
And I think at this point, you got to think that maybe Ygritte's like the most jarring of those. I don't know, maybe Oberyn, but she's been around for the longest.
She's been around for the longest and probably the most developed of all of those, right? Because it was so
most
many.
Developed and because we're emotionally connected to her through John, who is like, you know, one of the mainstays.
Yeah, yeah.
So that death, I mean, it could have gone either way. It could have been Ygritte, it could have been John.
Well, and it's episode 9, so you're like,
you know, someone's gonna get it.
Yeah. So I was actually surprised Sam survived.
Right.
It really felt like everything was leading towards us because Sam was so. It reached his level of nonchalance. Reached this level of not caring to a certain degree. He had something to live for with.
Yeah, Gilly. Like he's finally got Gilly back, right? So you would have it'd be a gut punch if Sam was.
Yeah,
dead. That's right. Okay,
like, so, because you could have easily done a John's about to take an Ygritte arrow, and Sam jumps in front of it.
Right. Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, I felt like this episode really, like in a lot of ways, I really haven't seen this kind of thing. Just everything from like the people that are on the wall that kind of have these chains or ropes that allow them to kind of shoot straight down.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen that before. Although I think that there's a Matt Damon movie about a wall. Who knows? Who knows what happens to that movie? No one knows.
Nobody knows. Matt Damon would be hard pressed to tell you.
I thought that the giant, like I always feel a little bit taken out of it when they're doing force displacement with the giants.
Mm-hmm.
Like it always feels like, you're doing camera tricks with me. But I never got that sense with these giants.
Yeah, I agree. No, they were very effective. I'm the same boat in terms of like, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed everything about it. And I think I was surprised as I was going through it that I wasn't taken by the battle fatigue at all. Because it was enough new things, and I think they did a good job balancing all the characters at the same time.
I think that there's something like 28 to 32 main characters of the show, depending on how you're counting. And this episode only featured 5 of the main characters. So, and that was the fewest number that they had done since the beginning of the show. They were just, it was sort of like a spotlight just on the wall.
Yeah.
And so you could really focus on and develop these characters without being distracted by, you know, what's going on at King's Landing or whatever. So you get the sense that Sam's gonna knock boots?
That's an interesting one. I think, I mean, I kind of get that sense, but I also feel like that'd be too satisfying. I don't trust the show.
Yeah. That's what he wants most in the world at this point.
Yeah, I think he's like, this could be it, man. I've seen a lot. I've done a lot. I've killed a White Walker. I've been in a battle siege. One last thing. One last thing before I go.
Yeah. So we'll see what that happens. All right, let's do some predictions. I'm assuming you haven't watched season finale yet.
I have not watched the season finale. Yeah, it was a challenging one because there was like, because you leave off the last one with Tyrion being sentenced to death, and then you get none of that.
And
that was, I think, even what made this episode even more impressive. What I talked about, like not having the battle fatigue, but also being like, oh, I didn't get any resolution for the last one. I was actually okay with it. This is kind of a gamble, right? If people don't, if people aren't into this part of the narrative, then this week is kind of a lost week.
So I kind of feel like the Theon narrative is, I've seen a nice little bow tied for him. I feel like I've seen the final scene of that narrative of the season. I feel like I've seen the final scene for Sansa, right?
Yeah, I think so.
It's almost like she is, those two are on a different trajectory. So Theon is like fully hit the basement of reekness. And Sansa seems to have, she's become something more. It's almost like she's Dark Hasselhoff Sansa now.
Yeah. So she's Garth Knight.
All right.
I don't feel like we've seen the final scene for Arya and the Hound.
I get that.
I feel like those two have been building to something, and so something's got to happen.
Right. Well, because didn't they just show up at the Vale?
They showed up at the Vale,
and she just laughed, and she was laughing at her aunt's demise.
Well, that's the second time she's gotten to the gate where one of her family members is just beyond the gate. Like, if they just go through the gate, they might actually see someone she's related to. And she gets really close to being reunited with a family member, and it just doesn't happen. So something's got to happen for those two.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this, like, she's real close to something, and it'd be kind of, you know, and so that tension's pretty high. And I think that's where she's laughing, right? She's like, it's just, why not?
Yeah, that's right. All right, so then Tyrion, we've got to see what happens with Tyrion.
Right.
Do you have any predictions?
Well, so I'm... I'm actually less convinced now that I actually thought, okay, the show's going to kill him. And I'm not saying that they won't, but I'm not sure that he dies like this. This seems...
The show's really good at like building up a character where you think, oh, everything's going his way or everything's going her way. And that's exactly when that person's going to get like a hammer in the skull.
Right.
And then, you know, you think a character, you see a character, boy, it can't get worse for that character. And then it gets worse. And
right.
Like, oh, they're going to die now. And then something miraculous happens and they, you know, they're risen from the dead or something like that.
I could see something bad happening to Tyrion and it's not death.
Yeah, I have a good I'm glad that you said that. I've got a friend who said this is a good show to make you expect an axe in the forehead. And so you always, you're sitting down to watch the show expecting an axe in the forehead. And you're kind of bracing for the axe, and all of a sudden there's like someone with a hacksaw that's just like chopping off your ankle.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good way
to put it. So it could be that Tyrion doesn't die, but something happens to him that's even worse or something.
Right, like some other, I mean, so Tywin sentences him to death, but that doesn't, I mean, they could come up with a different solution or he gets out, but it's a worse situation. I don't know, like that, it doesn't, because the whole concept too is like he's like beheading. It seems so like, that's it, you know, for regicide?
All right. So, yeah. So Tyrion, I feel like I haven't seen Arya's narrative tied in a bow for the season yet. I have not seen Tyrion's narrative tied in a bow yet. And of course, I kind of feel like something major has to happen with Dany because we've just been getting little glimpses of what's going on for her.
Well, and again, if the rules all sort of apply, these seasons tend to end with something with Dany.
Yeah, she gets, well, the last few, she's gotten more power, right? She either gets a new superpower or a new ally or a new army or something like that.
Yeah.
Seemingly, though, she's like holding a cordon on the top of a pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah, and we kind of had the sense, too, that she was supposed to be kind of laying low for a bit. Or this is, you know, build this empire, lead, get better at that gig, and then, you know, you send Dario off to Orzo. So there is a sense of like, well, what are you? What would you get now? Like, what yeah. what could happen now? Because I guess the thing that could potentially happen is Tywin is aware. So there could be a potential.
Right.
There could be a potential confrontation, right?
Yeah, sneak attack.
Like something that we don't know about because he's been doing that on the down low.
And less protection now that Jorah's gone, right?
Right.
So I think that we think we're right at the end of probably the most universally lauded season of Game of Thrones.
Four.
Yeah, season four.
Yeah, that's what we talked about how like it seemed to be when, but it was one that you had the seemingly the most issues with.
Well, there was now. I think that there was just that one. There. I think I've had a couple issues with every season, but season four happened to have that one dog of an episode, at least from my perspective. But I think that, I mean, just from the last few episodes, I think it's easy to forgive some of those missteps because they seem to have done so well with a lot of these other characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything to add to our dismemberment count?
Oberyn's teeth were removed.
Yeah, I wouldn't think of that as dismemberment. Although, I have no reason why I wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not. I mean, we all lose teeth, I suppose.
There's no dismemberment fairy. Which you think? You know, there ought to be a market correction on that. You know, the tooth fairy ought to be market corrected. You would think that other kinds of dismemberment would
warrant some sort of a reward.
Yes.
Yeah, especially if you're talking about a time when, like, you know, parts would be falling off people sometimes.
All right.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Thank you.
it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I will include a short excerpt of my longer conversation with Jan Doolittle-Wilson. Jan had some interesting things to say about Penny, who we meet in dance and who doesn't show up in the show. So because this is a Tyrion-heavy episode, I thought I'd include it here. Here is Professor Jan Doolittle-Wilson.
You know what we didn't get to, though?
What?
And we don't necessarily have to talk about it, but Penny.
Oh, we haven't talked about Penny.
We haven't talked about Penny. Penny's a character that completely gets overlooked. She's nowhere in the show version.
Yeah.
I kind of hope that she'll be more developed in the later books, again, if they're ever finished. But she's, I don't have to talk about Penny, but she's a really interesting comparison, I think.
Well, let's, Tyrion. You know, I don't think that we meet her until Dance of Dragons, right?
Right. Yeah, she comes in very late.
Yeah.
She comes in after Tyrion has already fled Westeros and is in a very dark place.
Right.
And it's just interesting to, she's really the only other character with dwarfism who is named and featured, you know, certainly not to the extent that Tyrion is, but how she represents just a different form of power and strategy, right? She's certainly not a character without agency, but she has none of his advantages.
Yeah.
She has none of his wealth. She is a woman. She has almost every disadvantage one can have in this world. And yet her way of negotiating her world, her way of surviving is so different from Tyrion's.
Yeah.
Tyrion looks on her with disdain in a lot of ways because he has different forms of agency that are available to him.
Right.
But as a reader, we look at Penny and think, but yet is her form of survival any less valuable than his, given what she has at her disposal? And she's really this great example of somebody who fully plays into her so-called dwarf identity, right? She fully plays into the stereotypes that people have of her as a way of saying, I'm going to so exaggerate what you think I am, because that way I'm able to survive in a world that expects nothing less of me and nothing more of me.
In a lot of ways, Penny's something of a mirror for Tyrion.
Yes.
In a way that a lot of characters are unable to be a mirror. I mean, in early on, there's something about Jon Snow that's a mirror for Tyrion, although their disadvantages present in different ways. But there's a part of Tyrion that has this self-hatred.
Yes.
And I think he projects some of that onto Penny. I think that there's part of Tyrion that thinks, as long as I act with nobility, people will treat me to a certain extent as a nobleman.
Mm-hmm.
Penny doesn't have any of that for recourse.
Right.
And
she doesn't. And that's not even a choice for her.
It's not even a choice for her. And so when he encounters her and really is sort of forced into her company in a way that makes him uncomfortable, I think the part of himself that he hates, he projects onto her.
Yes, absolutely agree. And doesn't, from his position of privilege in terms of class and money, and family name, it's easy for him to look down on her at first, right? To say, you're debasing yourself. Or I think you're right. Those parts of him that he knows other people see him as are fully exemplified in Penny, who embraces these, again, not because of any kind of self-hatred, right? Penny does it fully aware that she has to. You know, she is fully perceptive of these discriminatory narratives that really dictate her role in society. She's fully aware of what that role is. And her ability really to conform to that expected role might seem undignified to Tyrion, but it really allows her to really safely navigate this very kind of prejudiced and often violent society because she doesn't really have any other resources. So I think the juxtaposition of those two characters, I was sad when Penny didn't make an appearance in the film or in the TV version. It shows that, again, that kind of complexity. You know, I think you could look at Game of Thrones and be critical of the fact that there's not a lot of intersectionality in a lot of different areas, right? But Penny really shows us another side of what it's like to be a dwarf in a society without these other advantages that Tyrion has.
Tyrion's not without a point, though. I think he approaches Penny wrongheadedly. However, there is a part of him that thinks, you've chosen to an occupation that has not elevated people with disability. You know, you allow people to laugh at you in a way that has hurt me in my life. And of course, you know, that's there's a lot more to that, but I can kind of see Tyrion's point, at least point of departure.
I understand that that's Tyrion's point of view. I think he's wrong. Simply because an individual, regardless of who you are, you can only make a choice if you have access to a range of meaningful choices, right? And given space and agency to make a choice among those choices. And so, you know, when Tyrion looks at Penny and says, well, you're making a choice to do this, is she? Right? Choice is not, here's bad choice A and bad choice B. Decide, right? Choice is, no, you have the full range of choices that anybody in, you know, Tyrion's position would have. For Penny to make a choice, she needs to have that availability. Penny doesn't have the kind of choice that Tyrion has. Yeah. And so, yes, Tyrion's right in the sense that, okay, it's, you know, dwarf performers who are playing into these stereotypes that do make it harder for me to navigate my world. I understand his resentment of that. But from Penny's point of view, there is no choice.
Yeah, right? she's a survivor.
She's able to make a living. Yeah. She gets coin, right? She has a place to sleep. She is able to have some kind of independence, right? By playing into people's perceptions of her, that is her survival. Right. That is her form of agency.
Absolutely. That is. Yeah, for sure. That's her survival. Now, of course, by the other side of the coin is that, you know, Tyrion made a series of choices that landed him into, you know, this troop with Penny.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you could question, well, did he have to make those choices to land there? I mean, in some ways, they're in the same predicament. He just has fallen further, you know.
Yeah.
He fell from a place of privilege to this situation, and he resents it. And I think he resents her, just, you know, for illegitimately. You know, he has no right to resent her.
Yeah.
But I totally get why he resents her.
I do too. But, you know, the fact that Tyrion is able to even you know, move around his environment, his world. You know, going back to Cersei, you know, how often it has, you know, Cersei acknowledged that even as a woman, there is not even the mobility afforded to be able to change your location in the way that men have access to.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I think there are so many intersections with Penny. It's not just her disability. It's the fact that she is a woman. It's the fact that she's poor.
Yeah.
It's the fact that she's uneducated, right? It's such a nice, interesting. We see Tyrion in different ways because we have Penny, I think.
Yeah.
And Tyrion, you know, sees himself in different ways, I think, because of Penny.
Yeah.
So she's an interesting character. You know, I know that some have looked at Penny and have said, oh, here's our stereotypical depiction. And, you know, and yeah, she, but that's the point. Right. I think that's the point, you know, showing that, yeah, she is stereotyped, but Penny within that stereotypical depiction of how people see her is making the most of that in the only ways that she can, that are available to
so
her.
So I wonder if there's yeah, it's true. I wonder if there's a little bit of Tywin in his derision of Penny, because early on, Tyrion like has a talent for tumbling, right?
Yes.
And then Tywin puts a stop to it. I think the reason why Tyrion likes it is that he can make people laugh with his tumbling.
Yeah.
And I think that there's part of him that likes that element of it. And then, of course, this is something that Tywin has to stop because, of course, he's a Lannister. You know, he's not a tumbler. Lannister, you know, that's below the dignity of a Lannister.
Right.
And yet, and so he does put a stop to it. And so Tyrion has sort of been programmed to think that this is below his dignity.
Yeah.
To make,
but you know what's interesting too, though, about Tyrion is we tend to be most critical, as you acknowledge, of the things that remind us of ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so Tyrion, it's a form of masquerade, right? It's the idea, again, of so exaggerating aspects of how people see you to either survive or to gain an advantage, right? To disarm your opponent. I will so play into the stereotypes of what you have of me. Either I can make you laugh, which will give me a form of power, as Tyrion does, or, you know, whatever you're attempting to do with that. Think about how often Tyrion does this too, right? There are so many times where, of course, Tyrion stands up to the depictions of him. He pushes back against them. He defies people's expectations of him. But there are other moments where he thinks, okay, that's not going to work in this situation. Now I have to be the dwarf. In this situation, I will be the dwarf. Yeah, survive.
Yes. He becomes a curator of all the best jokes about dwarves.
Yes. I'm going to be the licentious, you know, sneaking around trying to get women, look up their skirts, drink wine. I'm going to be every stereotype you have of the dwarf, because in this situation, I can use it to my advantage.
That's right.
When he stands up in Lysa's court, right? In the film version, it's even more explicit, where he talks about, I am licentious and I'm dirty and I, you know, I do these things. I'm a terrible person. He plays into everything they already thought about him. And it's beautiful because he's got the court laughing and Bronn stands up to be his champion, right? So he does it too. He just doesn't do it in ways that are quite as explicit as Penny, right? That's Penny's, just about Penny's only strategy, survival. Whereas Tyrion, again, has choice.
Yeah.
There are times he can play up his stereotypical dwarfness. There are times he doesn't have to. Penny doesn't have those resources. Penny pretty much has just the masquerade. And I think Tyrion, you're right, sees that and resents it because it reminds him of how limited, even with his greater sense of choice, Tyrion doesn't have the full range of choice either.
I don't remember what happens to Penny. Is she still around?
She's still around. I think that he and, isn't it Tyrion and Penny and Jorah are all together at the end.
They've been enslaved, right? They've
been enslaved. Dany releases them from the pits, the marine pits.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're on their way to try to, aren't they going to join the Sons?
Yeah, maybe that's the case, because Dany is blown away, right?
Yeah, Danny's gone. I think they're going to try to rejoin Dany by joining the Second Sons. It gets a really convoluted there toward the end. But I think that's where we leave off with them.
That's interesting.
I'll have to revisit the last book, but I think that's right. Huh. So yeah, Penny's still around. So I'm curious to see if she'll, maybe we'll get a Penny point of view chapter, which would be fabulous.
I hope so.
One can only hope.
My thanks to Jan. A note about next week, I will have Linda Antonsen on. She'll be covering the next chapter, of course. But we'll also be diving deep into questions about ethnic representation in HBO adaptations. And we take a much different view on these things. And so it's an argument. It's a respectful argument. But I thought I would alert you to that. My feeling is that this kind of podcast is a good place for respectful disagreement. And so I hope you receive that interview in the spirit that it is intended. And that is all for this week.